Jesus says, but now I'm going to him who sent me, yet none of you asks me, where are you going? None of you asks me, where are you going? Now, the fascinating thing about that verse is it's not actually true. In the last three chapters, the disciples have asked Jesus specifically twice, where are you going? All right? So in chapter 13, verse 36, we read, Simon Peter asked him, Lord, where are you going? And in John chapter 14, verse 5, Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you are going. So what's Jesus on about when he says, none of you ask me, where are you going? All right? Either John has left the biggest blatant contradiction in the gospel that you could ever think of, or there's something else going on here. And the very next verse suggests the latter is the case. There's something else going on. Have a look. He says, rather, you are filled with grief because I have said these things. You are filled with grief because I have said these things. Now, in his commentary, Don Carson suggests that, look, while the disciples have technically asked Jesus where he's going, what Jesus is suggesting in verses 5 and 6 is they don't actually care about the answer. All they care about is their grief over Jesus leaving them. So the illustration that Carson uses is of a little child, all right? Just picture a little boy who's ready to spend Saturday morning with his dad. Dad promised he's going to spend the whole of Saturday morning with his son, and he's ready for it. But at the last minute, dad gets pulled away for an emergency at work. And in that moment, the little boy says, Dad, where are you going? Now that little boy doesn't actually care where the dad's going. All he cares about is that dad's leaving, right? It's the same with the disciples here. They don't actually care where Jesus is going. Like the little boy, they only care that Jesus is leaving them. They are filled with grief, verse 6. But Jesus now says, look, it's time to move past that, the grief. The reason being that where Jesus is going is actually more important than the fact that he's leaving. Right? For the little boy, the fact that dad's leaving is more important than where dad's going. For the disciples, where Jesus is going is more important than the fact that Jesus is leaving. And we know that it's more important because of what he says in verse 7. So let's read it out again. But this is the heart of our passage, basically. But very truly I tell you, it is for your good that I'm going away. Unless I go away, the advocate will not come to you. But if I go, I will send him to you. Now, two things to note here. First is, we can't be certain exactly which going Jesus is referring to here. Right? Is he referring to the crucifixion, where Jesus goes to the Father, or is he referring to the ascension, where Jesus goes to the Father? Now, there might be some here who think that between Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, Jesus spent those 3 days in hell. It's a common misconception that goes around the churches, but you will actually not find that in the Bible. The Gospels never suggest that Jesus went to hell for 3 days. He went to hell on the cross, but as soon as he died, he goes to the Father. That's what actually Jesus has been saying since John chapter 13. He's been saying, I'm about to leave you and go to the Father. But here's the question. Is the leaving, the going that Jesus is talking about here, the crucifixion leaving or the ascension leaving? And the answer is yes. Okay? It's both. Jesus needs to go through the crucifixion and the resurrection and the ascension before the Spirit can be sent at Pentecost. Now, the second thing we need to understand is we're not actually told why that is. We're not actually told why the crucifixion and the resurrection and the ascension have to happen before Jesus can send the Spirit. All we're told is that God has ordered it this way. Now, because God is God, he could have ordered it a different way. He could have actually allowed the Spirit to come when Jesus was still on earth, if he wanted to. I mean, the fact is, the Spirit was alive and active in the believers' lives when Jesus was on walking the earth and doing his ministry there, right? But for some reason, and we're not told why, God wants Jesus to return to the Father before the Spirit is poured out at Pentecost. And Jesus says this is actually an incredibly good thing. Right? According to Jesus here, it is better to have the Spirit in our lives than to actually have Jesus' physical presence on earth. And the rest of our passage is dedicated to outlining why. So let's have a look. And it starts in verse 8. When he comes, he will prove the world to be in the wrong about sin and righteousness and judgment. So what does this mean to prove the world to be in the wrong? He's basically going to convict the world that the world is guilty. Okay? The Spirit is going to show the world, and by the world, remember, John means non-Christians. So the Spirit is going to show non-Christians of their guilt. And they're guilty in three different ways: sin, righteousness, and judgment. Now, sin makes perfect sense. Of course, we're guilty of sin. Sin is bad. Sin is rebellion. Guilt, yep, easy. But what does he mean by guilty in regards to righteousness and judgment? They're a little weirder, aren't they? I mean, to begin with, what does it mean to be guilty of righteousness? Surely Jesus isn't saying here that we can be in the wrong when we're in the right with God. Like, that's what the word righteous means. It means right with God. Can we be guilty of being right with God? Is that what Jesus is talking about here? Well, it's unlikely. The best explanation looks to Isaiah 64:6 for the definition of righteousness here, okay? And what Jesus is getting at is he's talking about sort of righteous acts, if you like, doing good in order to try and earn salvation. And what Jesus is saying is, if you are trying to earn your salvation through good works, that actually leaves you guilty. And that's what many of the people out there are doing, aren't they? They're trying to say, oh, as long as I do more good things than bad things, then I'm okay with God. What Isaiah 64:6 says is that kind of righteousness, those kind of righteous acts, are nothing more than filthy rags. Filthy rags. They're useless. They're worthless. And the reason they're worthless is simple. You see, whenever we perform a righteous act or, you know, do good to others in order to earn our salvation, we are automatically negating the goodness of the deed. We're emptying that good deed of all its righteousness. And the reason is, it's not a good deed anymore. It's a transaction to benefit ourselves. So I'll give you an example. If you get out to Coles, right, or one of the shops down the road, and you want to buy some food, what do? You give money to the shopkeeper. Now, I'm not giving money to the shopkeeper out of the goodness of my heart, am I? I'm giving money to the shopkeeper because I want something in return. It's a transaction. I'm actually doing it for my own benefit. And it's the same with trying to earn our salvation by doing good. That good deed is no longer actually a good deed. It's a transaction done to benefit me. It's not doing good to others, it's doing good to myself. It's being selfish. All right? A good deed can only be an actual righteous act when it is done not expecting anything in return. Now, as Christians, we can operate like this, can't we? Because we know that nothing we do in any way, shape or form can add to our salvation, because our salvation is secure, it's locked in, it's been given to us as a gift. Non-Christians, however, they don't have that grace. And so whenever they try to earn their salvation, they are guilty of emptying their righteous deeds of all guilty, of all goodness. They are guilty in regards to righteousness. Well, then there's judgment. To be guilty of judgment, it just means to have bad judgment. Right? You just make wrong decisions, bad decisions. And the reason humans have bad judgment is because we're marred by sin. We're affected by sin. What that means is every single element of us, of our very being, is affected, whether it be in a little way or a big way, it doesn't really matter, but it is affected in some way by sin. This is actually why there's no such thing as free will. Did you know there's no such thing as free will? To have free will means to be able to make a decision with no external influences. But humans can't do that because we are always influenced by sin. And unless we have the Spirit in us, as Christians do, fighting that sinful tendency within us, we will always make the sinful, the selfish choice. Okay, so non-Christians are guilty in regards to judgment. They always make bad judgment decisions. So, that's role number one of the Spirit. The role of the Spirit is to convict the non-Christian world of the fact that their behaviour means they're guilty. Now, the fascinating thing about this is that was what Jesus did when he was on earth. I mentioned it last week. In John chapter 7, verse 7, Jesus says this: "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that what it does is evil." So the Spirit does the exact same thing that Jesus did when he was on earth. The Spirit just continues that on. And how does he do that? Guys, he does it primarily through Christians. It is through Spirit-filled humans, all right, Christians, that the Spirit testifies to non-Christians that where because of their sin, they are in desperate need of salvation. They are in desperate need of Jesus. And this is the reason, the first reason why it is better to have the Spirit than Jesus' physical presence. All right? The Spirit's just doing the same thing Jesus did. Now, if we had Jesus, that means we have one man preaching the gospel and telling the world that their sin means they need Jesus. If we have the Spirit, we have millions, millions of potential evangelists walking the planet, all over the planet, ready to do the same thing. All right? If only we could unleash that power. But more of that in a little minute. For now, I want to look at the second reason why it's better having the Spirit. So the first reason is having one man preaching the gospel is not as good as having millions of people preaching the gospel who have the Spirit. The second reason is seen in verse 13. Have a look. "But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth." I think that was one of the answers before. That's what the Spirit does. He guides you into all the truth. "He will not speak on his own. He'll speak only what he hears, and he will tell you what is yet to come. He will glorify me," that's Jesus speaking, "because it is from me that he will receive what he will make known to you." So the role of the Spirit is to declare Jesus' teaching. The Spirit takes what he hears from Jesus and then he makes it known to Jesus' people. Now, for the original disciples, what that meant was reminding them of what Jesus had taught them throughout the ministry, like Jesus' ministry, those 3 years. And the reason the Spirit reminded the disciples of what Jesus taught them was so that they could then teach others. And they wrote it down for us. So that's what the New Testament is. That is the apostles' teaching written down for you and me. Now, how does the Spirit then point us to Jesus? The rest of us that haven't seen Jesus in the flesh, right? Normal Christians, we are pointed, the Spirit makes Jesus known to us by convicting us of the truth that has been written down for us in the Bible. That's the second main role of the Spirit, according to this passage. He guides us into the truth about Jesus. And why does he do this? It's to make us better Christians. All right? The Spirit wants us to see Jesus more clearly so that we will love Jesus more nearly, dearly. And follow Jesus more nearly. That's what he's doing here. And here's the awesome thing, is that the Spirit can do that any time. See, we no longer have to be sitting physically at Jesus' feet to learn about Jesus like the disciples did. We can learn about Jesus anytime we want when we open this Bible and we ask for the Spirit's help. And that's the second reason why it is infinitely far better to have the Spirit in us than to actually have the physical presence of Jesus with us. We can be taught by the Spirit anytime, and he empowers us to be better Christians. So, they're the two roles of the Spirit, according to this passage. There's more. Two roles: convict the non-Christian world of their sin and teach people about Jesus to make them better Christians. Now, here's the thing. That is not automatic for Christians. Right? It is not automatic that the Spirit will transform a Christian into a better Christian. What is automatic is that Christians will have the Spirit living in them. You cannot, I mean, it's actually impossible to be a true Christian, a true believer, and not have the Spirit. Every Christian has the Spirit living within them. What is possible is for a true believer who has the Spirit to put out the Spirit's fire, as we're warned against in 1 Thessalonians 5. To quench the Spirit, to suppress the Spirit, to ignore the Spirit. Now, we can do that in a whole bunch of ways. I'm going to give you one example so you understand what I'm talking about. And the example is in regards to sin. Right? Every single time a Christian sins, we are suppressing the Spirit. We are not submitting to the Holy Spirit's presence and authority in our life, are we? I mean, it's actually impossible. It's impossible to submit to the Spirit's leading and sin at the same time. Because the Spirit is saying, don't sin. We have to ignore the Spirit within us to actually go and sin. Right? So while the Spirit is always present in a believer's heart, Christians will suppress and ignore his counsel whenever we sin. What that means, I mean, that shows, it's just an example of how it is possible for Christians to quench or to hinder the Spirit's activity in and through our lives. That's only one example. There are many examples of how we can do that. And the problem of actually doing that is that when we're ignoring the Spirit, we actually have no recall left to us but to live our lives in our own power. We're not asking for the Spirit's power anymore. We're suppressing the Spirit. We're quenching the Spirit. We're ignoring the Spirit. And we're living our lives in our own power. And do you know what happens when humans live their lives in their own power? They get human-sized results in their life. Human-sized results. I'll give you an example. Take the church today, for example. Right? The church today has more earthly resources than it has ever had in history. We have more money than ever. We have more property, more people, more teaching, more Christian books, more access to sermons from around the globe, more leaders in our church today than throughout history. Yet we're going nowhere. We're going nowhere. We're going backwards as a church. Now compare that to the church in Acts. The church in Acts had almost zero earthly resources, yet they took over the world for Jesus. Now what's the difference between a church with God-sized results and a church with human-sized results? Well, there might be a number of reasons for that difference, but one of them must at least be in part due to the fact that the church is working in its own strength and not in the strength of the Spirit. So what do we do? How do we get to have God-sized results in our life rather than human-sized results? Well, I'll tell you what we don't do. Right? We don't get out there and work harder. Right? We don't try and muster up more willpower to tell people about Jesus. We don't try harder to love Jesus more. We don't exert more energy to display the fruit of the Spirit. Like I say in the news sheet this week, it's not called the fruit of hard work. The fruit of the Spirit. Francis Chan, in his book Forgotten God, he says, the way ahead is not to muster up more willpower. He says the way ahead is to focus all our energies and our time on asking for help from the one person who actually can change our hearts. We ask for the Spirit's power. We ask the Spirit to change us, transform us, grow us, so that we can actually show God-sized results. So here's what I want us to do this week, right? I want you to get out a pen if you've got one, or get your phone out. I'm going to give you three passages we're going to look up, and we're going to pray those passages. This is what we do. If you want human-sized results in your life, then ignore this. Switch off. If you want God-sized results in your life, get out a pen and write these passages down. Passage number one, Ephesians 3. We're going to turn to Ephesians 3 this week, and we're going to pray it. I'm going to read it to you. This is Ephesians 3, verse 17. I pray that you may have power. Now, that power comes from the Spirit. Okay? I pray that you may have power together with all the saints to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, so that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. The only way you and I are going to be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God, the only way we're going to reach full Christian maturity, is if we ask the Spirit to show us how loved we are in Jesus. Right? You've heard me say this time and time again. If you haven't started praying this yet, I don't know why. You've either been living under a rock, or you're not listening or ignoring me. We have to be praying this prayer or we'll get nowhere. Stuck in human-sized results. After that, we're going to turn to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5 is where you find the fruit of the Spirit. And we're going to pray that God will so transform our hearts that we will have divine quantities of the fruit of the Spirit. We will actually have more of the fruit of the Spirit than our non-Christian neighbours, all right? We want more love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. We want more of that than the non-Christians who live around us. And after we've done that, we're going to turn to our third passage, Matthew 28, the Great Commission. And what we're going to do is we're going to claim that promise. Jesus said, I will be with you until the end of the age. The way Jesus is with us from the end of till the end of the age is through the Spirit. We're going to claim that promise, and we're going to say, Lord, please empower us through your Spirit to make me into the kind of disciple that can go and boldly make other disciples. Friends, the reason we are accomplishing human-sized results in our lives is because we spend too much time on our feet, doing it in our own strength, and not enough time in our knees praying for God's strength. Imagine what we could accomplish if we had God's power turned up to full inside us. But guys, if that's not motivation enough, all right, if having God-sized results in your life is not motivation enough, let me give you the real motivation as we close. That real motivation is found in Galatians 3:14. The Apostle Paul reminds us in Galatians 3:14 of what Jesus just told us in our passage today. Galatians 3:14 says this, He redeemed us, all right, so he's talking about his going at the cross, He redeemed us in order that the blessings given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Jesus Christ, so that by faith we may receive the promise of the Spirit. And what that means is, I want you to understand this, what that means is that Jesus had to go to the cross so that you and I could receive the Spirit. Spirit is not a small gift. It's the most expensive gift ever given. Think of the most expensive gift you've ever given and multiply that by about infinity. That's how expensive it is. That's how valuable it is. We have the most valuable gift ever in the Spirit. May we not spurn that gift. May we not suppress that gift. May we not ignore that gift. Instead, may we be people who fall to our knees this week and pray for the Spirit's power to so transform our lives so that we can accomplish God-sized results.